speculation had become crazy.
Once you form the mountain to be buckled, you have enormous profit.
You just turn this one dial.
The most power-paying profit I've ever taken.
Owning a share in American industry is like owning a share in the future of our nation.
Bacon until you make it.
Now is the time to buy.
And then all of a sudden you change the world.
Go mortgage your house and buy Bitcoin with it.
Doing what you want to do in life is like being on vacation every single day.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Griftonomics. Since the early 2000s, social media and social networking has played a key role in how we internet users across the world interact with each other. But in more recent years, major privacy concerns and the approaches to moderating content on these platforms has become an ongoing debate. Some argue for so-called free speech absolutism, regardless of the consequences, while many others see the inherent dangers of letting these systems run unchecked. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, there's some big money and influence that's creating interesting dynamics when it comes to who is running these platforms. To discuss where things are headed, today we're joined by Eugene Rochko, creator and CEO of Mastodon, an open source federated social media platform that itself is based on open web protocols. Welcome to the show, Eugene.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on. So let's just get started with a little bit just in general. What is Mastodon and what is your continued kind of role in maintaining it?
Well, you described it pretty well. It's an open source piece of software that you can use to create a social media platform, kind of like you were able to use software like PHPBB to create a forum back in the old days, but with a big difference that unlike all those forums that were standalone, isolated systems, the social network that you create with Mastodon is interoperable using open web protocols with other such networks, creating, in essence, a decentralized social network.
Gotcha. Yeah, and for the people that are maybe a little less technical, is it fair to say it's kind of like Twitter, but multiple people hosting their own Twitters and they can all talk to one another?
Yeah. You can definitely say that. Imagine if you had many little Twitters and you could follow people using other Twitters from your Twitter.
Gotcha. But I think that one of the key benefits of that in that federated model is that there is no kind of one central point of control, right? Like anybody can start their own instance, right?
Indeed. It lies in the middle between the two extremes of network topology, where one is the centralized bit, where you have just one website and everyone's using it, and the other extreme is the distributed network, where everyone is an independent node in the system, in a kind of like in a peer-to-peer way. And the federation is between those two, and it benefits from allowing people to run their own nodes under their own control and not being beholden to a centralized authority. But at the same time, it does not force you to always maintain your own node, to manage your own private keys, to always be connected to the internet. You can just connect to somebody else's node and use it like you would use a traditional website.
Exactly. Awesome. And there have been many attempts at kind of federated, decentralized social media over the years. But I think a lot of people have probably heard of Mastodon, and it seems to have had the most success. Do you think there's something that has kind of set Mastodon specifically apart from the other attempts in the past?
Yes. I think that to some extent, the previous attempts have flowed into what we have today, because the protocols and platforms that existed then sort of merged or became the platforms that we see today. Back in 2016, when I started working on Mastodon, we started by using the decentralization protocol that a previous platform, Identica, and later Statusnet, was using, which is called AllStatus. That protocol never reached the standard status. It was just a draft. Nevertheless, it was to some degree in use at the time, and Mastodon kind of popularized it at the time. Then a year later, we switched to a more modern protocol called ActivityPub. But ultimately, you can sort of see the connection between previous federated social media attempts and current pirated social media attempts, especially because some of the successors of Identica have actually adopted ActivityPub now. So there really is a lot of just continuity.
I like that. Yeah. I like that it's like a building technology and that it's just building on previous standards that have kind of risen up rather than coming in and declaring something entirely new one night.
Yeah. Indeed. I never considered myself a protocol designer. I just wanted to create a product that used standard protocols.
I think you know, as a Mastodon user myself, years ago, I something that stood out to me is I think you really simplified the user experience as well, which I think can be hard with protocols, right? So I think that has also helped a lot.
Yeah. I think it is true to some extent that Mastodon really did something different, and the effect was very different when it launched. Because as we've established, these platforms did exist. And in fact, I think Identica was quite popular in the 2010s and so on, but it sort of fell out of favor as commercial social platforms grew. And the GNU Social, which was its successor at the time that Mastodon was started, existed and was in use by some people, but it was very far from mainstream. It was very far from being known or used by a non-technical audience. Most of the people on there were programmers or activists for free software. And so the question is very valid. What did Mastodon do different? And I think I put a lot of emphasis on user-friendliness and visual design. I wanted to create something that looked good. Mm-hmm. And that was easy to use and did not require you to be a programmer to understand. And I think I was to some extent informed by years of trying to get my friends to use XMPP chat. back when there was still federation between Facebook and Google Talk. I was able to run my own XMPP server and chat with my high school friends who were on Google Talk.
I completely forgot that interop existed. Just pivoting slightly, I think, you know, we talked about how, you know, the cool thing here is that it's actually building on years and years of development up to a point and then fixing the UX of that and making it easier to use. And the cool thing is it's all been open source and free. Just slightly off topic, but in some ways related, I recently did an episode on Web3, and it seems to have come in and just said, nope, we're going to reinvent all the standards for this. And by the way, it costs to participate in the network. I was wondering if you have just any kind of opinion on Web3.
I think it's a scam. Like, that's my overarching opinion on Web3. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's very, I think it's very unambitious, because your idea of Web3 is just having like a Firefox add-on that adds like a wallet to a normal web page. And otherwise it just, you know, it's either that or just, you know, some idea of something that doesn't even work in the browser. Like, it's between those two.
Yeah.
And I think it's just incredibly impractical and self-serving. It's a, like a solution in search of a problem, like cryptocurrency itself.
Exactly. Hammer in search of a nail. Yeah, no, that's good to hear. And I thought you might think that way. It's definitely, I think a lot of people also don't understand that by, you know, doing that browser extension, there is actual points of centralization that are being incurred through that. So, yeah. Awesome. So just getting back on topic a little bit. In recent years, there's been a really big focus on the term free speech, and it's a loaded term. And it's become a selling point that these newer social media networks or attempts at social media networks are trying to convince others that they're supporting and that you can have free speech on their networks. I'd love to know just like what your take on what that term really means is. And do you think that, you know, a network or a technology has to have a hardline position on something like free speech to really exist?
I think that arguments about free speech attract a very certain specific kind of audience that you may not necessarily want to associate your platform with. So at Mastodon, we've been very careful about not really leaning into that, not really advocating Mastodon as a free speech platform.
Yeah.
Even though it, in some ways it absolutely is, because, you know, it's open source software that you can use to maintain your own social media that is completely independent from anyone else. So there is nobody to tell you what to post and what not to post. But I'm not particularly interested in appealing specifically to the audience for whom that is the primary selling point, because they are usually interested in that sort of speech for nefarious purposes.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, like you said, you know, you can have free speech on Mastodon. I think something that's interesting is that the networked communities in Mastodon, they kind of self-moderate themselves, right? So
indeed, you know, it kind of is both ends here. Like, on one end, it is kind of like, as I said, a platform for free speech, but it also gives people the ability to actually moderate in a much better way than commercial platforms like Twitter. On Twitter, you need to wait for the management to make a decision to change the policies, and then for the moderation team that they hire to respond to reports. On Mastodon, you have your server, which is much smaller in comparison to a centralized platform like Twitter or Facebook. And you have the management of that server that is a lot easier to reach. And if you don't like what they're doing with moderation and their policies, you can just start your own or switch to a different one that aligns with your values more.
Yeah, in many ways, that's a more flexible solution to the moderation.
It is much more flexible, and it also more flexible in a legal way as well, because you're not longer subject to, you know, rules from the United States of America. You can't be subject to rules in Germany or France or wherever you're located, which I think is a lot healthier for a global communications
network. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. Cool. So back to free speech. I was reading another interview you'd done where you mentioned that there have been some networks out there who have borrowed Mastodon's open source code, because it is open source, and then package up, you know, what is essentially, you know, the free ability to post hate speech under the guise of free speech, and then putting some ads on top of that and actively monetizing that. To me, that feels like a little bit of a grift and a little bit dishonest. So I'd love to hear your opinion on that. But secondly, how do you feel about, you know, these kind of often hate-filled networks kind of borrowing your Mastodon open source code and repackaging it?
Well, the good news, I'm only aware of it really happening twice. The bad news is both are pretty high-profile cases. So you're probably thinking of Truth Social, Trump's new social media platform, which, I mean, I feel a lot more relaxed about it now, because I don't think Trump has ever posted on there. So as far as I'm concerned, it seems like it's just a throwaway thing, not really active or important. And the other one is also right-wing leaning platform called Counter.social. It does hurt me on a personal level to see, you know, the work that me and my team have put into creating this platform that is centered on an idea of decentralization being basically turned into commercial centralized competitors to Mastodon, because that's what they become as soon as they turn off the decentralized features. And oftentimes there, I don't know if they put ads on there. I'm not really sure. I don't remember saying that, but I know that at least in some cases they put basic features behind paywalls. They often don't actually update very often, so if there's like a security issue that we patched, often they don't catch on for a while. So it's not good.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that makes sense.
On a personal level,
and I think it's in some ways, you know, it actually doesn't make sense. It's a paradox, because they're saying that they're all about free speech, but then to your point, they don't typically enable the federation features or federate with other Mastodon instances, right?
Yeah. Oh my God. I actually forgot. I can't believe I forgot Gab. But it hasn't happened twice. It happened thrice. I'm sorry. It actually happened with Gab. I completely forgot they existed. But yeah. So just more to the point. The thing is, they don't really stand out from the other two that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Basically, they all three of them did the exact same thing. Take the code, disable decentralization, put paywalls on basic features, and I don't know, do their own thing inside.
To me, that just is the grift, though. If you truly believe in free speech, like, you wouldn't be afraid of enabling decentralization or honestly actively trying to participate in it. But I don't think they show any interest in doing that. So, you know, I think that shows you where they are. But I know you had an interesting run-in, you know, with Truth Social, which you mentioned, where they might have been redistributing your code without the kind of proper licensing. Like, did they address and fix that?
Yes. Initially, they did violate the terms of the license, and we had to get in touch with a lawyer agency, and we sent them a letter informing them of this, because as part of the license, which is actually quite forgiving, the federal general public license is quite forgiving for violations if the person who is doing the violation actually fixes the problem. So we needed to inform them of this issue first, and then if they didn't fix it within like 30 days, then there would be grounds for a license breach. So after we sent them the letter, they put up a link to the source code. They complied.
Okay.
As revenge, they put the little note thanking me personally, saying it wouldn't be possible without me. No need to mention that I didn't help them in any way whatsoever. It's just I just see it as petty revenge.
Well, at least they complied. I guess that's good.
Going back to your earlier point, yeah, it absolutely is a grift. The thing is, it is actually in people's interest to participate in the decentralized network, because here's the thing: we're all struggling against one common issue: network effects.
Yep.
It is so much harder to start a social network because there's nobody there, right? Mm-hmm. When you have decentralization, you're not starting from scratch. You're starting your own node, but all the people who sign up there can follow a vast existing community and get, you know, content delivered to their home feeds.
Yeah.
When you disable decentralization, you're just abandoning all of that, starting from scratch at a disadvantage. And the only reason to do that is to pretend like you're doing something new. Like, if I remember correctly, with Gab, before they switched to our code, they did a crowdfunding campaign where they crowdfunded quite a large number amount of money to create their social media platform. And then in the end, they just copied our code and we're done with it. So there's definitely
raising money for the development of something and then just copy pasting somebody else's code does sound a little bit like.
And none of them are very upfront about using Mastodon code.
Well, you can understand why they'd want to hide that.
For compliance with the license, usually they do have like some disclaimer somewhere and a link to the source code. Sometimes you need to literally like squeeze it out of them by sending them legal letters. But they will never like actually say, oh, you know, we're just using Mastodon. They did all the work. We're just running the code.
That's it. Yeah. It's really free speech in name only. You know, it's a facade that I think a lot of people put up. One of the big challenges that a lot of what we've just talked about seems to boil down to is moderation. And, you know, we've seen that even large, you know, companies, whether, you know, you think they're good or evil, but they have a lot of money, like Facebook and Twitter, they've really struggled to either invest in or really crack the nut that is moderation. And So do you think there is a good solution to moderation when a network gets to the size of, you know, literally billions of people? Or, you know, do you think the solution is this kind of smaller, independently moderated network like Mastodon kind of uses?
I mean, I'm obviously biased towards towards Mastodon. I think that's the solution, unsurprisingly. I think that there is a certain scale where centralized moderation cannot keep up and cannot make everyone happy, most importantly. Mm-hmm. Because you run into things like, okay, so you're enforcing US laws and these people are in Germany, and so now suddenly you're banning things that are perfectly legal. Mm-hmm. Or you get, you know, pressured to silence accounts who protest the Turkish government because Turkey requested it from you, and so on. And you know, when you've got like a centralized social network, you don't have a lot of choice in how this is handled. So if the company is pressured into doing it, then that's it. Then that's all you can do. With a decentralized social network where this workload is distributed between different servers, you have options. If one server is pressured by a hostile government, then you know you can switch to another one. Mm-hmm. If the policies are bad, you can switch to another one. And because there's a smaller amount of users on each server, moderation is essentially easier because the global workload is distributed across all those different people who have the power. It's essentially a much larger moderation team in combination.
Yeah. Yeah, you've decentralized that moderation in a sense, and you, in essence, kind of made it a more manageable task. So,
I mean, we're running here with the assumption that for the most part, each server only needs to moderate their own users, because the assumption is that other servers also moderate their own users, and there is some agreement about common rules and values. Gotcha. And you know, when a server does not aligned with those rules and values, there are options to just block it from your own, so you can sort of deal with different
yeah approaches. That's an interesting point you bring up, and one thing I was going to ask about, like, well, firstly I'll just say I do think that most people who kind of run around yelling just free speech probably have never dealt with the idea of or dealt with moderating a large global audience that, you know, where different laws apply, where users have different beliefs when it comes to what free speech should be or how heavy moderation should be. But you brought up a really good point about the interplay in different instances on Mastodon. And I know that in the past, I think there was a little bit of kind of, you know, not controversy, but there was some stuff that went on between Mastodon instances, right? Just to do with, because they're federated, because you might have users who follow users on another platform, another community, that instance that you're a member of will then kind of, I guess, cache and store the content from the other instances, which there may be like kind of legality issues with. Like, is that something you've since kind of come up with a solve for, or?
Solution is just block servers where content that is not legal in your area is produced. That is really the only reasonable solution. I mean, I remember there really isn't like a better solution than that, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yeah, but the cool thing is that instances have that option, right? So,
yeah.
It makes sense. Yeah, just getting back to kind of like what I was saying about people not understanding the moderation challenges. You know, when I first saw Elon Musk bid on Twitter, that was kind of the first thing that came to my mind, is that I don't think he understands what he's getting into in terms of moderation. You know, now that more has come to light, I don't know if he truly intends to actually purchase Twitter or, you know, even ever have to deal with that moderation challenge. But
it definitely sounds like he wants out of that deal now.
He seems to be doing a bit to try and get out of it. And, you know, maybe it is. He was like, oh no, like moderation is actually not as easy as just saying free speech and then walking away. You know, regardless of whether he actually ends up buying it or not, like, I'd love to just understand your thoughts on, you know, the centralized kind of powerhouse that is Twitter and, you know, just the power structures that you think might be at play if the richest man in the world actually did become the owner of it.
Well, interestingly, I originally in 2016, one of the reasons that I started working on Mastodon and looking for alternatives to Twitter was that there was talks that another billionaire was going to buy Twitter. So that was kind of on my mind even then. It was Peter Thiel back then.
Right. A friend of Elon Musk, yeah.
I think there was talks that he might buy it or that Disney might buy it, because I think Twitter was at a really low point in 2016 before Trump's election. I think that was the event that actually saved Twitter, making it relevant.
Sure.
Because it was, you know, downward slope from then on. Now, I think that ultimately my problem is with any one person being in charge of international global communications network. I think that stuff is too important. Mm-hmm. Like it's like the telephone or email or, yeah, you know, or other forms of communication. I've run out of. I made a list of two items. I think.
But you're basically saying it's like a public utility in a sense.
Exactly. It is like a public utility, and it's important that it's not just subject to the whims of a single company or a single person. That stuff's too important.
I completely agree.
For the motivations, who knows? I mean, wasn't there talks about that person who was posting Elon Musk's flight patterns on Twitter?
I saw that.
He tried to buy out that account, and then the person refused. So what? Now he's buying Twitter?
I think there's multiple, you know, we can only speculate as to what it actually is. But like you said, he seems to actually be like kind of slowly backing away from it now. So who knows what will happen. On your point about, like, you know, the centralized control and like the idea of this being more of a public utility, I do think that's something that I've heard Jack Dorsey in the past talk about back when he was running the show at Twitter. And, you know, he always kind of led people on with this, like, yeah, one day it's going to be a fully open kind of ecosystem. But then the actions of, like, how much they clamped down on their API didn't really, in my eyes...
You know, I'm not going to claim that I've kept up with everything that Jack Dorsey has said over the years, but I believe that what you're referring to, he said literally right after he stopped being the CEO and having any power over...
That's probably how I think you're right. Yeah. So do you think that's just BS? Do you think that there's actually any future in which they will, you know, try and make Twitter, you know, the next Mastodon, like an open protocol?
I mean, it's interesting because they did start the Blue Sky project, mm-hmm. and they announced it in 2021, I believe. Mm-hmm. They started a Matrix group, invited a bunch of project leaders from different decentralized platforms on it, mm-hmm. and let them argue it out for 2 years. They finally founded an actual legal entity for Blue Sky this year, possibly a couple months ago, maybe even more recent than that. I'm afraid the time flies, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure when anything is anymore. But basically what I'm saying is that the first actual movement has happened only very recently. And for a long time, that project was in a kind of state where it was very doubtful that anything would ever come out of it. Yeah. And I had my doubts about the intentions behind it, because if I wanted to make Twitter decentralized, I could do it a lot faster than 2 years, and I wouldn't need, you know, to have anyone argue with each other and try to sell. Because, you know, like when you invite a bunch of different project leads from completely different separate protocols, platforms, and softwares, mm-hmm. everyone's going to be interested in having their thing validated and adopted by
exactly
a larger community. So it really is a kind of thing where there's not going to be any winners.
Yeah, you get a lot of cooks in the kitchen and everyone has their own agenda, right? Or their own incentives.
Yeah. The right thing to do would have been there to just, you know, pick one and stick with it. There wasn't really... That's the interesting thing. There wasn't actually any real involvement of Twitter in that project. It's almost like Twitter or Jack Dorsey started Blue Sky, but under the guise of making Twitter decentralized. But then there isn't any actual connection with Twitter. So I was wondering, like, why? What could be the reason for that? And I think one of the potential reasons would be to sort of because there were some discussions about Twitter being a monopoly and potentially being broken up by regulations or something like that. It could be seen as sort of going ahead of that and doing it on your own terms, or at least pretending like you're doing it so that people don't pressure you, you know?
Gotcha, yeah. Yeah, that's always my question. Like, is it like a marketing or PR stunt, or is there actually some meat to it? And is
that's
it going
what it to... felt like to me? Now, yeah. Of course, recently, again, I'm not sure how much time has passed since then. They actually announced a thing that they've come up with called ADX, it's a new protocol, which again I find disappointing because we already have a widely successful decentralized social media protocol that is in use today, that has a community and momentum. And now, you know, they're trying to come up with something completely new again. So, of course, disappointment on that side. I read through it. It seems to actually adopt a lot from ActivityPub and Mastodon in terms of, you know, that they're also going with the federated model. There's a lot of stuff that's left out of it that's, you know, not sure how they're going to do it yet. There's no mention of, like, activity streams or how they're going to actually format the data and so on. There is something that looks very much like a blockchain in the middle of it.
Okay, I see that Jack got his blockchain in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think one of the questions that I always ask, like, I don't get me wrong, I would love if there was some sort of beautiful path towards Twitter becoming fully decentralized and that public utility you speak of. But I think it so relies on it, you know, free speech being monetized through ads, really, in a sense, that I wonder about, like, how the scale would kind of function and how they would pay for it. Because obviously running the data centers that power Twitter isn't free. Like, I'm sure there's no doubt a cost associated with that. How do Mastodon instances typically cover their costs without, like, slapping ads over everything?
Crowdfunding, Patreon, donations, some people close registrations and then send invite links in exchange for Patreon support. So in essence, it's like paid accounts. And that's what I would actually do with something like Twitter if I wanted to monetize it, because I think that's the most fair way to do business. We provide a service, you pay for the service. That seems completely fair and does not require tracking, privacy violations, advertising, none of that nonsense. I'm paying for my email server, so why not for social media? That, of course, there is another issue here, and that is the number of people who are willing to pay for something like that. Mm-hmm. It might indeed be much lower than the amount of people who would use Twitter for free.
Yeah.
So there is that.
Yeah. Well, I guess the advertising model, just even outside of social media, is so prevalent, right? Like, there are so many things that we consume for free, or seemingly for free, but that's because, you know, we're being served ads or our data is being collected. So, it's an interesting
thing. The thing is, I think there is some stigma against like crowdfunding and Patreon as not being like a real business model. And in some way it isn't, because it's not guaranteed, right? But I think there is some validity in it's kind of like a freemium model, I guess, in the sense that, okay, so the service you're running is free to use, but you're definitely going to have people who are happy with what you're doing and who want to continue to see you doing
it.
So they're going to support you financially. And it might actually work out. It doesn't fit the capitalist model of like maximizing profits and getting huge returns to investors and stuff. But, you know, if you're just running a Mastodon server, just, you know, without seeking to get like monetary return from it, but instead just having it be something sustainable, like a sustainable business.
Maybe it could be set up as a nonprofit or something, right?
Yeah, definitely could be. I mean, there are Mastodon servers that are set up as a co-ops. You know, you enter a co-op and you become a user. You get to participate in governing decisions of the server and so on. So there's a lot of diversities that in how you can approach this that is facilitated by the fact that it's a decentralized network and you can just run your own node however you see fit. So you can really test out different business models if you want.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing there that you brought up, and it's the key point, is that existing in a capitalist society, though, the incentives probably aren't aligned for that future to unfortunately exist. I'm guessing Twitter investors want to make money, unfortunately. So,
yeah, that's one of the reasons that I'm not sure. I mean, okay, so the whole Blue Sky business, like with them being so separate from Twitter, in a legal way, and with Jack Dorsey no longer being the CEO of Twitter, I'm not really sure what's the plan here for Twitter actually adopting anything that Blue Sky comes up with. And it, from day one, I was like, I'm not sure what Twitter's interest is here in actually becoming decentralized, because right now they're in a advantageous position, right?
Yep.
They have the majority of users who are locked in and can't leave. And so they can use those people how they see fit, by showing them ads, by getting their data and so on. As soon as they open the floodgates and allow people to leave, people are just going to leave. Yeah. I mean, some people are going to stay, but there a lot of people are going to leave, and it's only going to be worse for Twitter in terms of their business model.
Monetarily, so, yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. It'll be interesting to see. Like, I haven't kept up to date with the Blue Sky thing, but I don't know. Part of me is sitting here hoping that something actually becomes of it, because, you know, step in the right direction. Just kind of anchoring back on the notion of again, free speech. You know, it is often being used, as we discussed, to kind of justify hateful speech or harassment. And there's been several cases that I know have gone before lawmakers in the US here and also around the world, with regards to what platforms should be expected to do there. I'm just interested in your thought of what should come next there. You know, do regulators need to step in more heavily? Should we just say communities can figure this out? And, you know, I don't think your answer is yes to this, but is Elon the savior of free speech? What's the future hold?
Wow, that's a very, very wide-reaching question, isn't it? What should lawmakers do next? Well, I don't know. I'm not a lawmaker. I think that when we're approaching the topic of regulation, the danger is that regulations often favor the monopolies. They often favor the big players who can... who have the sufficient resources to comply with red tape. And lawmakers often only consider the large players when they design regulation, which can make stuff complicated for smaller platforms, like somebody just running a personal Mastodon server for their friends and so on, or like a small business running a Mastodon server.
Right.
So on one hand, regulation is a risky business. On the other hand, you could argue that if there was regulation that told you how to moderate, that it would make moderation easier, because it would no longer be kind of in your hands to decide, but you would rather just follow the guidelines. But that's just, you know, just a side note. I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, it is. I'm in the same boat as you. Like, I think it's a double-edged sword, and you're absolutely right that often that regulation can really just make the smaller players disappear because of compliance, and that's how you end up with large monopolies like Twitter. So,
Good
point.
Challenges of moderation are often in just the variety of cases that you get to see, and it all interacts with the rules that you've set forth in very different ways, and it requires a lot of thinking, a lot of decision making to always make the choice of how to proceed with you know, a report of something on the platform. It's it's very often not black and white at all. So just in that sense, I'm thinking, like, if there was guidelines that came from above, it could alleviate some of that by just, you know, making it more straightforward. But again, I'm not advocating for that. I'm just thinking about it.
No, I understand. Like, it's a tricky thing, and that's what I was getting at earlier. Like, I don't think a lot of people who just kind of parrot the hashtag free speech really understand the inherent challenges of it. It's not a simple black and white, or Boolean kind of this is right, this is wrong situation.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue that probably even most people who consider themselves free speech absolutists would not actually enjoy a completely free speech, like no moderation platform, because it would be overrun with spam in seconds. It would just be completely filled with spam. You would not be able to find any legitimate content to actually read. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, to our earlier discussion, like, I think they know they wouldn't enjoy it because the free speech absolutists are actively turning off, you know, decentralization that would bring in maybe dissenting points of view into their platform. So even that, I think, seems a little bit too spicy for some people. And so,
for sure. They usually just want free speech for their own viewpoints, but not anything that disagrees with them.
Yeah, that sounds about right. This has been really, really interesting discussion. Where can people learn more about Mastodon, what you're working on, and just kind of generally connect with you?
You can follow us on Mastodon. Mastodon at mastodon.social is our official account. You can follow us on Twitter if you're still not on Mastodon, at joinmastodon. You can read more on our official website, joinmastodon.org.
Is there, like, if somebody, I'm guessing a lot of listeners are probably on a mobile device, is there an easy way for them to get started on, say, an iPhone or something like that?
Yes, we've recently released our own official native apps for iOS and Android.
Nice.
We've worked really hard, and we hired professional user experience designers to create a user-friendly experience that looks nice, polished, and on par with commercial alternatives. We've optimized the onboarding experience, so you can install the app, and without knowing anything about Mastodon, you should be able to sign up and find some interesting content to get into your home feed and start following people and just start using it like you would use anything else.
That is fantastic. I am going to actually go and rekindle my Mastodon profile and make sure I'm active there, because I think it's the right thing to do. And who knows what's going to happen with Twitter, honestly. So, awesome. Well, thank you, Eugene, for coming on. This has been absolutely amazing conversation. Thanks everybody who listened in.
Thanks for having me. It was nice.
Awesome. Thank you.